tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Hello, you are listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Ray Barker, an archivist in the Special Collections Department, the MLK Library. This episode is our 10th. It's part of Notes from the Library series. Today, in the first part of our episode, we're talking to the president of the Washington Psychotronic Film Society, Carl Cephas, a.k.a. Dr. Schlock, and his assistant, Jonathan Kochenauer. About their organization, its history, and details regarding their programming, exhibitions of experimental, odd, offbeat, obscure, and anything but the norm films at Smoke and Barrel down the street here in Adams Morgan. The second half features Pat Padua and Robert Headley, co-authors of a book on DC's theater history, both regular theaters and movie theaters. So we're going to do this in two parts. And I'm going to begin with you, Carl, or should I call you Dr. Schlock?
You can call me Carl.
Okay, Carl, just tell us a little bit more about the organization, the Psychotronic Film Society.
Well, a friend of mine named Melanie Scott was in the room with me and her husband. We were in the band together. And she said, Carl, would people want to get together in a club setting or outside the regular movie theaters and see a so-called B or a low-budget film? I said, they sure would. And then she put a notice in the city paper, and we got hundreds of replies, and we had a so-called meeting of about 100 people, and that was in 1989, almost 88, but 89 we got together, and 89 was the year WPFSW got started.
Right, and so just sort of admitting this out to everyone to hear, one of the reasons I invited both of you guys here today is because I was intrigued by the name Psychotronic. The website, if I can say that, looks very decidedly late 1990s, early 2000s.
Yes.
HTML-ish. And so I just wanted to learn more about the organization. So the word Psychotronic, can you talk a little bit about that?
It has a meaning like something about mind warfare or mind games. And the term psychotronic was from a film called The Psychotronic Man. So a guy named Michael Walden did a book called The Encyclopedia of Psychotronic Films. And he didn't just want to call the films B films or bad films. So he put the term psychotronic, again, meaning mind or something to do with cerebral and something that it made you like go, And it took off. Suddenly we had the Cannes Film Festival. We had Mystery Science 3000 riffing the films. But there were people who loved the films, people who made fun of the films and then on. But the encyclopedia brought all these people together. Cause no one knew how to, what the genre or what was called. But once he put that out, there were people wanting to form clubs. And we were one of the first ones in the nation to do that.
So that's one of my questions. That sort of are there like organizations across the country that are similar to this?
Yes, there's even one. I think someone in Sweden or someone across the globe want to do it. There's one in Savannah. There's one in Seattle. There's one in Chicago. And a friend of mine wanted to start one on Alaska, but he went to Hawaii. So there are clubs forming all over right now as we speak.
Great. And then... are you guys both from D.C., the D.C. area?
I'm from D.C. I'm a townie.
I've lived in D.C. for about 10 years now.
So that's Jonathan being quiet over there in the corner. But, you know, Dr. Schlock, you got a lot of words out here.
Yeah.
But I'm just going to talk to you guys about how you met.
How Jonathan and I met?
Yep.
Well, I believe it was we were playing out in Dr. Dremo's in Arlington. And we've been all over town, the Lucky Bar, DC Space, 930 Club, 15 minutes, and we were based at Dremel's for about 3 or 5 years, Jonathan?
I forget the exact year that it started, but I remember that I started going there in 2004, you know, and it was after that. That was for about what, 3-4 years before it finally shut down.
Yeah,
and then it was on hiatus for a little while. You jumped for, to a couple other places.
Yeah,
and
I lost my job and my health, and we went on a deep hiatus. But Jonathan kind of helped us with the tech work and with the web page, and that's why we're still going today.
Yeah, what I remember is that you'd started it back up, and it had been going for a couple of months at what was it, Warehouse Theater?
Yeah, the Warehouse.
Yeah, in the gallery there. And I didn't know for like the first 2 months that it was actually going. So like when I finally started showing back up, I was kind of like, well, we need to start like Facebook page, a couple other, you know, email list, whatever, just a couple other things to kind of keep people informed.
And I wasn't web savvy at that point. I'm still not. And he was.
You still had the web page up, but that was Todd. And
yeah, and he liked to keep it like in that 90s style for some strange reason. Todd.
It seems to fit the you know, personality of the club somehow for me. But so I went to your screening last night. You guys are doing these every Monday night down the street at Smoke and Barrel. And I was just going to walk through what I experienced, and I thought you guys could tell me what you think, you know, someone can expect when they come. But So when I went last night, Jonathan was setting up all the technical stuff, and this is around 7 o'clock. And then you showed up, Carl, with your lab coat on and started sort of pseudo-lecturing everybody about, like, the movie that's coming.
And a door prize.
And the door prize, you know, and then you called me out, and you called me the dude at the bar, and I had to I was forced to tell everyone about this podcast. I had no choice. And then the home-baked cookies were passed around, and then a loop of the film of UFOs flying around the Capitol, and it just felt like things had finally started. But can you walk through other aspects of what you guys do?
We've also become a baking club. Every Monday night, someone in the club bakes a concoction that has something to do with the film. If it's a slime movie, there'll be slime cookies. What else have we had, Jonathan?
Let me see here. One time we did, or I remember one of the ones I did, was an attempt to make fortune cookies, which ended up being misfortune cookies. And
we did Kitty Litter for a cat movie. That was a kitty litter with granola as kitty litter and Tootsie Rolls and rolls of chocolate as the duty.
So is the same folks are coming to this night after night, or what does that look like?
We get a chunk of regulars, a chunk of strangers, and then we do what we think is a popular film, and no one shows up. So it changes every week.
Go ahead, sorry.
But we try to make people, if they don't enjoy the film, they'll want the door prize. I made the mistake of showing a film called Franken Pimp, and everyone walked out. And I said, I'm stopping the film, and it's door prize time, and they all came back in.
And then there was a second disc.
Yeah, we didn't know about. Yeah.
I have to bring this up. Now, guy started talking to me at the bar last night, really nice guy, and said that one of the reasons you left a previous place where you were exhibiting because...
Oh, yeah.
You want to share that?
We've shown some risque films. Like at one club, we had a prison film. A woman was in the shower. A woman said, oh, I saw a breast. And then one place, there was a scene where a man was being sexed to death, and the owner said, Carl, my regulars saw something on the screen they didn't like, and this is your last night here. I said, oh, really? And we were bounced out to someplace else. And we've also shown something called the Pig Effing Movie, where it's a Belgian film where a man sort of slowly makes love to a pig. But a friend of ours took that film and spliced it into a Porky Pig cartoon. So it starts out as a Porky Pig cartoon, and then a man slowly making love to a pig, and then it ends with Porky saying he's swearing off real life.
Well, great. That's, you know, I wasn't expecting to hear that today. So what makes a good, quote-unquote, good screening for you guys?
Just more than 7 people.
Really?
Yeah.
And Jonathan?
I think just being able to show films that we haven't seen, sometimes haven't seen ourselves before, and, you know, even if they're not, you know, well known, that, you know, they actually are very enjoyable.
They're like, it's like Rocky Horror. You're in a crowd of people who know the film and want to be around people who also enjoy the film, whether they're going to riff it or enjoy it or just like say, wow, it's just as good as I remember or just as bad as I remember, and that's it.
And so the Oscars were a couple of days ago. And does that mean anything to you guys in terms of what you're doing?
I met the director, Guillermo del Toro, at DC Film Fest. And I told him good luck with his film because I was doing a comedy called Big Bad Elf. Mine flopped on DC TV, but his is great. But we have done Academy Award nominee films, but it's because there's something about the film that makes you want to say, what was that all about? And we don't just do bad films, and we like to call them movies of peculiar interest. You know, like Valley of the Dolls or a Pat Boone film where he tries to get people off drugs, anything. Blaxploitation, giant monsters, you know, kids from space.
Yeah. Films that make you think, but you can still have fun with.
Yeah.
So that's what I was going to say a little bit more. You know, I think there's a tendency for movies like this that are sort of out of left field where they're easy targets to make fun of and laugh at, and it's the Mystery Science Theater thing, and I get that that's fun for people. But last night it wasn't quite like that, and I guess if we could talk a little bit more about sort of this appreciation for things that, like a genuine appreciation for things and not just laughing at them.
Yeah, some people have read Michael Elder's book, The Psychotronic Film Encyclopedia, and they have only read about it. We find these films and we show them. So so these people are sometimes seeing the film for the first time, or they remember seeing it and they can't find it anywhere else, and they want to bring in a friend and say, hey, you've got to see this film. And we enjoy it with them. But sometimes there are some moments where the film, you have to heckle or you've got to riff it because it's just so out there. Like, you know, like Terminator, where it's, I'll be back.
We've had technical difficulties before where, like, the sound went out, and so, you know, we just had to fill it in.
Yeah, we showed a Serge Gainsbourg film that was supposed to have been in French, but the copy didn't show up until the day of the screening, and we invited the French embassy there. And when we got the film, we heard, like, Je ne comprends pas. It was because the film was dubbed in Spanish with English subtitles. So the French embassy walked out, and we were like, "Ooh, sorry about that."
where do you get these movies? I know the website says Trash Palace. Is that your resource, or is it just anything?
Trash Palace, Video Vault, my collection. I've been collecting films ever since the movie got on VHS. I even collected Super 8 films when the movie came out in comic books. But now I have a collection of about 2,000 films on DVD and VHS. And I'm trying to convert the VHS tapes to DVD, but sometimes they don't stick too much. Mm-hmm. But we find movies all over the place, from 7-Eleven to Walmart. You wouldn't believe how many people don't know what they have in their discount dollar bins.
Sometimes we get them from some of the, genre DVD companies that are DVD and Blu-ray companies that are out there now. Shout Factory
and Wild Eye Publishing, Wild Eye. Yeah, and Severin Films. They did the Birdemic. They
Synapse,
came in.
Yeah. Arrow.
Great, and then so I'm going to ask you to indulge me here a little bit. I just wanted to say, you know, growing up in the 70s in the suburbs, we didn't have access to cable, and so, you know, Friday and Saturday nights, my brother and I, 10 or 11 or 12. It would stay up late, like a lot of kids. So 1-2 in the morning, when the regular programming was done, there could be sort of anything, and it just felt like all the adults had gone to bed.
Yeah,
no one's minding the shop, and we would just come across some crazy movie. Sometimes at midpoint in the movie, we didn't know the title. We just sort of locked into this sort of other reality. Would wake up, you know, wake up the next day. What was that? What happened? You know, and is this sort of that kind of feeling you guys are aiming to get with some of this stuff?
You have to sometimes host these films, and you have the so-called horror host that, like Svengali and Count Gore Duvall and Sir Graves Gasly, and the ghost host like in Baltimore. But as a matter of fact, Count Gore is going to be at the AFI this March with Night of the Lepus, but. These films were, like, sometimes heavily edited, but they were so campy and so out of this world that at midnight your minds were tired and sleepy. You dreamt about these films. They were just out of this world. They were like just great films, and there were no copies of them. Then VHS and Beta came along. You could save these treasures.
And that's what we're doing. Some of it's like going to, like, you know, like you might have been to, like, you know, video store, like, as a kid, and might have seen, like, a bunch of these covers, but maybe never got to see the films themselves, like, at that time. And now, you know, we're kind of being able to go back and revisit some of that.
I used to live at in the 70s. My parents knew where I was Saturday and Sunday, because I would go to the theater at the church with my communion or collection money and walk 2 miles to the Coral Hills Theater. And from 2 o'clock to 7 o'clock, I sat through four features of the four times the movie, and I would just love it. And the cashier was so nice; she never carded me. I saw R-rated films, early slasher. I saw a female breast. I saw the whole kit and caboodle.
And that started very young. And you,
very young.
And what does your personal film collection look like at home?
It's nice. It's deteriorating. I've had to sell some, but and a lot of tapes got damaged due to wear and tear. But it's a nice eclectic collection.
And can we talk a little bit about, you know, the film The Room, which I saw. I was telling you earlier, Carl, that there's you know, there's obviously technical
issues. Tommy Wiseau?
Yes, yeah. With that film, and it's a midnight, you know, screening at the midnight show on E Street. And it's a little amateur and clunky and awfully confusing at times and such. But there's also something really pleasurable to me about watching that movie, and other people too. So what is that, do you feel?
If that film had been done 20 years ago, it would not have been as popular as it is now. Because the rumors had a new audience after Rocky Horror. Because back then we had Plan 9 and Manus, Hand of Fate. And other things, and then we evolved on to Trolls 2 and all these other films. But The Room has hit a new audience, and it's about in-depth filmmaking, and it's just out of this world seeing where you have all this talent and all this technology, and you can't, you have to do one thing to do a film, and you've done it wrong. And that involves a lot of riffing right there.
And riffing meaning just the audience plugging in stuff.
Yeah,
to make
talking back
sense
like Rocky Horror, saying, "Oh, you know, like what's the famous line in The Room? I did not hurt whatever that. What is that, Johnson?
I believe the line is, "I did not hurt her. I did not hurt her. I did not." Oh hi,
hi.
Hi, Mark.
Yeah, and that's a famous line everyone knows. And they bring in props like inflatable footballs. They bring in spoons and such. Right. It's the new Rocky Horror without music. Mm-hmm. There is music, but it's not as catchy as the Rocky Horror, Richard O'Brien's soundtrack.
And so the calendar for upcoming films is at www.wpfs.org. And so for this month, we did the Revenge of the Zombie, and I left before I got to see if the zombie got its revenge or if there even was a zombie in
yes,
the movie.
He did. It wasn't the normal zombie. It's about these two kids who were telepathic. They used some ancient book to draw hieroglyphics on their father's face to kind of jumpstart him. Then they used their telepathic minds to revive the father from the grave and to make him do killing.
He sought out revenge against the bikers that had killed him.
Creepy twins in the lead.
They were like the girl, the guy, mm-hmm. and Disney's Escape from Witch Mountain.
That's right, yeah. And so could you guys break down quickly what you do actually as a team? I mean, I just kind of summarized it earlier, but can you guys define for us what you guys do?
Well, John comes in early and does the so-called, what I call the floor show. He does a themed short films and cartoons. And you can tell you what you do, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, like before each screening, I tried to have some kind of a themed pre-show of, you know, it may or may not be related to the actual film that we're going to be showing that evening. Outside of that, I also do, like, you know, try to get the promotions and graphics, posters, trailers, whatnot all together before we, you know, for the screening itself.
Yeah, and as Dr. Schlock, I like to bring in the audience, even people who aren't there to see the film. I see them looking at the screen, and I explain to them that we're a film society, and we love film, and you're welcome to stay. And sometimes that convinces them to stay, and I tell them about the door prize, and sometimes they will stay just for the door prize, which could be a toy or a very rare DVD or something else. And then I announce the movie, and we run maybe a few shorts, and then the main feature. And after the film, we draw numbers from a cup, and if it's your number, you win the corresponding door prize.
Well, great. Yeah, it was a lot of fun last night. And we're going to take a little break here. We'll come back, and I'm going to ask for Carl and Jonathan's your recommendations for films that people should go out and try to find. And then we'll continue.
Okay.
Original music by Flash Frequency, DC native. Find him on flashfrequency.bandcamp.com. We will be right back.
Hello, welcome back, everyone. We are speaking to Carl Cifas and as Dr. Schlock.
That's me.
Jonathan Kochenour from the Washington Psychotronic Film Society. And we're going to wrap up your segment here with just recommendations. Any one or two films you feel like anybody listening should go out and go find however they can.
Any John Waters films? Andy Mulligan, Ed Wood. Did I say Ed Wood? I'm sorry, I'm being. There's Cash Flag. What do you think, Jonathan?
If people haven't seen Bad Boy Bubby, that's one I would definitely recommend.
Bad Boy Bubby?
Yeah, Bad Boy Bubby.
It's an Australian film, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah.
From the 80s, 90s, 60s? What?
The 80s.
I thought it was like 90s, but.
Okay. Maybe it was.
So we've got Bad Boy Bubby and
My favorite is Dead Man's Shoes.
And there's a noticeable silence in the room.
Yeah, that's an Irish film. It's a very nice, slow, disturbing, whatever.
Well, great, guys. Thank you. We're going to move things over. Thanks a lot for speaking today.
Okay. I get it.
So we're moving on over to talk to Pat Padua and Robert Headley about DC theaters, about DC movie theaters and the sort of the history, and talk a little bit about your book with us at all. And I have a list of questions, of course. But can you just tell us a little bit about who you are?
Well, I'm Pat Padua. I work at the Library of Congress by day, and I also am a freelance movie critic. I've got bylines in the Washington Post. I write for Spectrum Culture, and I was writing for DCist until it was shut down, but that'll be coming back soon.
Yeah, and that's how I first learned of your work.
I'm Bob Headley, and a retired linguist from the government, and I've started working on movie theaters in 1968, and did a book on Baltimore movie theaters, and then another book later on Washington movie theaters, and I had thought about the idea of doing a book on Washington movie theaters, a sort of a picture book for Arcadia, several years ago, but it was just too much. I had too much to do. And then Jeff Krulik told me about Pat, his idea, so it was a perfect fit, and we just started then.
So you guys met through Jeff, and Jeff is a local documentary.
Yes.
And he's made Heavy Metal Parking Lot. He's working on a film now about Raz. Crew, but you guys met, and so Pat was able to pick up some of the work and carry that for you. And what does the research work look like for you guys?
Wow, finding pictures of the movie theaters, one big problem. It's so hard, especially the early movie theaters. There were photographs of them, and they've disappeared, or else they exist in a newspaper or an exhibitor's magazine as very bad pictures. But
it's just poor quality.
Yeah, but it's all we have. So we got the pictures, then we decided what pictures to use, We split it down the middle. Pat took the part after, 1945?
1945. Yeah. And I think it's more 60-40 in your favor.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. So breaking down the time frame, Bob, then, so if he's post-45, where does your time frame start?
The first theater we have was built around 1889, I think.
And can you tell us roughly where that was in the city?
Yeah, it was down on Pennsylvania Avenue. I think where the... Maybe where the Archives is now, somewhere in that area. And these are not movie theaters, mind you.
Right, these are theater theaters. And I was going to talk about that a little bit more, about that, about, you know, the theaters and just as places for performance and what kind of artists and performers would pass through these city or through the cities and through D.C. and these theaters in 1889 and forward.
Oh, my goodness, everybody passed through. I mean, you had the great actors of the late 19th century. You had the burlesque people, the vaudeville people, the great comedians. Geez, right off the top of my head, Bob Hope was here. Sid Caesar was a very early performance at the Metropolitan Theater in 45. And you just name it. They all played here, either vaudeville or just on the stage.
And so so when did your interest in these theaters develop? When did this start happening, that you're able to sort of identify in your own lives when that happened?
Well, we're from different generations. you know, I think Carl and I are from approximately the same generation, but really for us, for my generation, it started with the Circle Theater, which used to be on Pennsylvania Avenue near 21st Street, and it's now a Kaiser, is it still Kaiser Permanente? It's off.
Something like that, yeah.
But that was a place where you could see, you know, recent second run films and 60s and 50s classics for a dollar for
But I mean, personally, like Bob, is as a kid, or like
one of my first memories of a movie is going with my parents. We lived in just outside of the downtown Baltimore, and we went to a movie theater called the Irvington, just a neighborhood theater, and I was sitting on somebody's lap. I think it's my father's lap. And the movie was called The Miracle of O'Morgan's Creek with Eddie Bracken. I don't remember anything about the movie. But
it's a Sturgis, Preston Sturges film, right?
Maybe so. The miracle was she wasn't married and she was going to have a baby, I think. I didn't know that at the time. So we're watching this movie. Then the previews come on, and they showed previews to this Ray Milland movie called The Uninvited. Scared the daylights out of me. You saw the doors opening by themselves and the lights going out suddenly and music was eerie. That movie scared me for I don't know how many years of my young life. And it's been going to them ever since.
So it's a, you know, movie theaters are a place where you can go to be scared in the dark with strangers or feel joy and that sort of thing. So there's just a range of emotions.
Every emotion known is in the movie theater. If you could bottle all this emotion, the tears from movies like It's a Wonderful Life, and you know, you just—it's incredible. And people—it always makes me laugh when people say, "Gee, I watched a great movie on my cell phone." You can't see a movie on a cell phone. We saw Casablanca several times on TV. Great movie, even there. Then a friend of mine, Paul Sanchez, rented at the Greenbelt Theater. On the big screen, it was like a different movie, and it was wonderful again. So I just laugh at people who watch them on the little screens.
Yeah, you want that big, the big scope and everything.
Yeah.
So who attended the movies? I mean, can we speak generally about the audience, either in, you know, pre 45 or post? Like, what did the people who would go look like?
Okay, I'll take.
And we're speaking about D.C. and your book is just D.C. or is it the region as well?
It goes into some of the suburbs. When movie theaters started moving out of the suburbs in the 60s and 70s. Well, in the old days, before my time, people dressed up to go to movies. In fact, there's a story in Baltimore. There's a big first run theater called the Century, and the movie critic was going to go there and see a movie. And he didn't have a tie on, and they didn't want to let him in. I mean, people really dressed up then. Men wore hats and suits, and women wore dresses. And And at some point, it changed. And the movies, there were also the kids' movies, the Saturday morning movies. And that was a totally different audience. I don't know whether we have those anymore.
Well, before my time in the 50s, when television was coming up, we saw a lot of theaters closing, a lot of the old movie palaces closing down. But as the baby boomers came of movie age in the 60s, there was an uptick in theater construction. And they weren't quite as ornate as the theaters that came up at the turn of the 20th century. But and also they were opening more up in the suburbs instead of downtown, which at one point was where all the first-run movies would be playing.
Right, and we're talking a little bit about transitions here, the transition from the city to the suburbs, but also a transition which I find appealing is just the performance theater into when they're implementing movies and film into that setting. And do we have a sense of how many of those, that first wave of theaters are around now?
The first wave of theaters? Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. Really? Okay. Probably one of the earliest ones that's still around is the Avalon up on Connecticut Avenue. That's that was originally built as the Chevy Chase. I think it was 1923. It's probably the oldest operating one in the area.
Mm-hmm. And then a sense of volume of theaters in the city. Is it comparable at its height to other cities? Do you have a sense of it, if D.C. was a movie-going city or any? And do we have anything to compare it to, you know?
It's compared often to Baltimore, and they matched each other for the first few, say, first couple of decades of the 20th century, having about maybe 70 theaters. We're talking about maybe 1910, 1912, something like that. But then D.C. sort of slowed down. It was saturated. And the other at that time, places like Chicago and Philadelphia had several hundred theaters.
Okay, and we're going to get to your book in a second, but can you talk about one of these sort of historical events that, not being from D.C. myself, I'm aware of this event, the Knickerbocker Snow Tragedy in 1922. Mm-hmm. Would either one of you want to field that question and share with us what the significance of that event is?
Yeah, that was one of the biggest disasters in D.C. history, and also the worst disaster to a movie theater in town. It was January 1922, and the Knickerbocker Theater was a high-class theater up where 18th Street and Calorama come together, that sort of point of land.
So very close to here, actually.
Yeah. Right? And Harry Crandall and some others built this theater, really nice theater called the Knickerbocker. And it snowed that night, very, very heavy, wet snow, and people were watching a movie called Get Rich Quick Wallingford, and sometime during the movie, the weight of the snow forced one of these big I-beams, steel I-beams, to come loose from the wall, brought down the roof. The roof fell onto the balcony, and everything fell into the audience. There was one story of a man who had worked in the mines in West Virginia, and he said he was sitting there, and he heard a creaking noise, and it sounded just like in a mine when the part of the wall or ceiling was going to give way. So he just got up habitually and ran out of the theater just in time. The wall came down and it blew him out into the street. 98 people were killed and a whole lot more were injured.
And so a sad event, certainly. Yeah. And then so I wanted to ask, is there anything in your research that would surprise us to learn about the theater history in D.C.?
I'm not sure.
I've stumped. I don't know. I've stumped you guys. This is so great.
Well, I think one thing that might surprise people is how many theaters are in the book that don't exist anymore.
And then we can move on to the book, and I'll follow up with that in a second. So you'd mentioned earlier, Bob, I know the Arcadia Press tend to be just images with a little bit of some captions. And now what will the format look like for this publication?
Pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. Pictures. We're going to send in the final version today, and keep our fingers crossed.
Nice. So we have an anticipated publication time?
Yeah, I don't know. Pat, do you know when it's going to be ready?
I think it's in the fall, sometime in the fall.
I think it.
And the publisher is?
Arcadia.
It is Arcadia,
Press,
okay. Yeah. And so, and to follow up on that note, Bob, about people would be surprised to learn how many of them are gone. So the book is published and people can use it as a guide to walk around the city and say, that CVS over there used to be the place where such and such theater was.
Or that vacant lot used to be a really nice theater. Sure. Mm-hmm. So many. You don't realize that. And nowadays, we put a lot of modern theaters in there. Some of the big megaplexes and multiplexes. And you don't realize that the theater companies, the exhibitor doesn't own this theater. He leases it. And as soon as the lease is up, 15, 20, 25-year lease is up, the rent will go up. He can't afford to, the margin is so small, he can't afford to run it, and it changes into something else.
Okay, and were there any big major players in the city at that time in terms of who owned the theater market and who was sort of dominating that scene at that time? Was there a sort of name power movers in the city that's coming to mind?
Well, back then, say in the 20s and 30s and 40s, you had Crandall Theaters, Harry Crandall's Theaters. You had some smaller groups, Wineland Theaters, and then KB Theaters came along a little bit later, and they were well into the 70s when they had most of the theaters. But the big name was Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers had a whole bunch of theaters in the area.
So the Warner Brothers that everyone is familiar with.
Yeah.
And they would just pick a city, pick locations, and build from the ground up? Or how did
a lot of times they would, and they might own the theater. KB owned a lot of its theaters. They didn't lease them back then so much. But, Pat, I don't know, what are the big people now? Regal?
Regal, Lowe's, or did Landmark. And that was great to have an art house chain like the Landmark. And mm-hmm. Angelica's opened the Mosaic and is the pop-up near Union Market.
Yeah. The Angelica. Mm-hmm. So we're wrapping things up with you guys. I just wanted to know what the documentation, being an archivist myself, what does the documentation look like? We talked a little bit about that when we started. So in terms of your research, you have a theater name, you have an address, uh-huh. and you guys start your research and you start digging into stuff. Do you have a sense of, generally speaking, existing documentation of any of these places? So we talked about how the theaters aren't surviving, but do the materials survive?
Most of the time you can find something. Occasionally you don't find anything. You find a list, an address, and nothing else on it. But I guess the book I did on Washington movie theaters back in the 90s is good documentation, because I have list them all with the information on them. So we use that. But I don't know, Pat. Where did you go for documentation?
Well, it's what has been surprising is how hard it has been to find even an image of a theater like the Biograph that was popular. It only closed in the 90s, and I had to dig the Peabody Room at the Georgetown Public Library had a photo, but that was all we could find. A lot of the research was having a theater in mind that we wanted to represent. And Bob has a massive collection that covered a lot of it, but I also did some research in the Washingtoniana room, looking for specific theaters. But the Biograph I couldn't find there.
Okay, so that's great. Anything else you guys want to talk about? We can close this out.
No, thanks for having us on the program.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's
and been thanks
fun.
To Carl and Jonathan.
Great. So I'm just going to wrap it up here. We were speaking earlier with Carl Cephas, probably got that wrong, a.k.a. Dr. Schlock, and Jonathan Kochenauer from the Washington Psychotronic Film Society. Keep your next Monday evenings open for the next few years. They'll be continuing on in their tradition of showing films in the city, and with Pat Padua and Bob Headley. So thank you guys. This has been an episode of DC Public Library's Notes from the Library. On Full Service Radio. To learn more about the DC Public Library, please visit us at dclibrary.org or follow us on Twitter/Instagram at DCPL. So we have upcoming events. It's Saving Family Treasures, Personal Archiving Workshop 101 at Mount Pleasant Library, March 17th on a Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m. And we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the 1968 riots with a pop-up museum April 7th from 12 to 4 at the Anacostia Library. Follow us at Twitter at DC1968Project, hashtag DC1968. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.